Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Just declared it all black, you know, hey, no, there's no more racism. And when you look at a black person, you're really looking at another white person. So forget about it.
Mm.
And you ain't entitled to nothing special. You know, hey, y'all talking about affirmative action. Affirmative action for who? We all white. You know, don't believe your eyes.
They've been having...
Ain't no such thing as color. It ain't no colored people. It ain't no colored people. It ain't no white people. We're all just citizens of the world.
While the nation is preoccupied with the coronavirus, the work of counting the country's residents continues. One big question throughout the history of the U.S. Census is how to categorize different races and ethnicities. NPR's Code Switch podcast is reporting on the many implications of what box you check. Here's NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates.
The census is 230 years old, and for all that time, there's always been a racial category.
The Constitution required the separation of the slave and the free populations.
Margot Anderson at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee has been studying the census for her entire career.
The first census in 1790 had to identify free people and slaves, and they used the word white, so it was free whites and other free people and slaves.
30 years later, though, they had started using the term free colored. It was assumed slaves were colored. Then another distinction.
By 1850, they began to put in the term black or mulatto.
And it continued to change. Only some American Indians were counted until the government declared all, on and off the reservation, citizens in 1924. By the mid-1800s, Anderson said, other populations were being counted.
Chinese show up in 1870, Japanese in 1890.
Those categories weren't always entirely accurate, and they were influenced by public opinion.
The biggest example of something coming on and going right off is Mexican in 1930.
That racial designation lasted for one census cycle, one. After it appeared, Mexicans on both sides of the border objected, and the Mexican box was removed 10 years later. So Mexicans became white again in the 1940 census, and in 1970 became part of a new category, Hispanic. Hindu was actually listed as a racial category in 1940, even though that's a religion, not a race. All that finally changed in 1952 with new naturalization laws. Then there's identity. Before people were allowed to self-identify, a census taker or enumerator made the decision. Looking at you, he or she decided what you most likely were based on where you lived and who else was in your household. And those households are more diverse than ever. The numbers of interracial marriages and multiracial families continues to increase, and lots of those people don't want to have to choose just one thing. Multiracial advocates have been pressing since the late 1980s for more diverse categories, and in 2000, they got them.
The public essentially, when they see the form, reacts to it. And people are reacting right now to what they see on the 2020 form.
And those reactions likely will change the categories on the 2030 census. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans.
Ronald Lewis has died. People in New Orleans knew his name, and so did listeners to this program, because we first met Ronald Lewis amid the wreckage of Hurricane Katrina. In 2005, we stood listening as he took a phone call while standing in New Orleans' lower Ninth Ward.
Hello. Yeah, I'm right here at Desalon and Johnson Street, bye.
Just behind Lewis was a wall of rock where engineers repaired a breach in the levee. Just in front of him was a concrete porch, the only thing left of the house where he was born.
Our family house, all the new houses they built on Desalon, they're gone. You know, like gone. Not no rubble, no nothing.
Ronald Lewis lost everything. His own house was flooded out, as was a tiny backyard museum that he ran. It honored the tradition of Mardi Gras Indians, African Americans who dressed like Native Americans and danced in parades.
The Mardi Gras Indian and Associated Pleasure Club is the true black history here in New Orleans. I'm not leaving my home. This is home. Only way I won't be here is I'm forced out of here.
The audience of this program followed along for years as he rebuilt his house and his museum better than before, and even authored a book on Mardi Gras Indian traditions.
After Katrina, you know, he was highly motivated.
His friend Bruce Sunpie Barnes is chief of a cultural group that Lewis joined called the North Side Skull and Bone Gang. We asked Mr. Barnes to help us remember Ronald Lewis, who developed a respiratory illness a few weeks ago. He died in March at age 68. Family members say he tested positive for the coronavirus. COVID-19 killed a man who helped to bring back his city after Hurricane Katrina.
When so many other people were thinking the city won't come back, the spirit of the city is broken, Ronald was one of those white doves that took over immediately to help people recognize and realize that we could bring everything back. All was not lost. And when he created his museum, the House of Dancing Feathers, that's exactly what he did. He became a beacon.
This collection showed the resilience of the people, because we had lost everything, but we didn't lose hope. And so every piece in here is symbolic of that, of us rising up out the ruins of Katrina and say, we are here, we're back.
Lewis found a role with Skull and Bone, even though he wasn't healthy enough to march with them. When they left their base to perform, he would wait to welcome them back.
He would stay behind because he wasn't as mobile as he used to be. Arthritis and a few other ailments, and when we'd come back, he would greet all of the people. He was a wonderful greeter, and speak to them about the tradition. And we'd come back, we all sing and chant and dance together, and so that was a beautiful thing.
So Mardi Gras was late February. Did you see Ronald Lewis then?
Yes, I did. He came out. I was so happy to see him, and we greeted each other with hugs and danced a little bit, and I was really happy to see him in such good spirits. He had had a hard year the year before with some dialysis and other things, but he had gotten past that, and he was moving and looking great.
When it became known that he was sick, how quickly did he decline?
It was fast. Within 8 to 10 days, he was gone. And, you know, he didn't get his test back until after he had passed. You know, things were slow at that point, but because he had the symptoms, you know, we thought that, yeah, it was true.
I don't think it was very clear at the time of Ronald Lewis's death, but the statistics make it clear now that this disease has been more deadly in the African American community than in others across the country, although it's deadly to all kinds of people, of course.
Yeah.
What have you thought about it as that news has spread?
There was some early fake news, if you will, about people posting things online. People were posting things saying, black people, it's not going to touch Africa, in particular African Americans. And I was telling friends, please don't listen to that madness, because, you know, this thing is literally coming for us.
I want to just notice one more thing as I listen to you talk about Ronald Lewis. I can hear in your voice that he was an enormously valuable person to you, that it was an enormously valuable life that he lived.
Absolutely. You know, Ronald's one of those once-in-a-lifetime friends that you hope you get to meet, someone that uses a lot of wisdom, stark honesty, and then how to lend a helping hand. He showed by example. He might call you up and run something by you, see what you think. He might just call and say, hey, man, I'm just thinking about you. How you doing? He did that, you know, often. He would call you in the morning and check on you. And life has changed for us all. You can't reach out and touch somebody, say hello. You can't hug them. You can't shake their hand. Can't risk any of those things right now.
His wife, Charlotte, told us that she was allowed to have a small funeral, I think up to 50 people.
Yeah, they did have a small funeral. We were not really getting the opportunity until later to honor him in the way that we really want to, and, you know, according to tradition, you know.
Oh, you'd like to have a second line. You'd to have a real New Orleans funeral. You'd like to have a party.
Yeah, we're going to have a real New Orleans funeral, and we will do that at some point, you know, and honor him for having been the person who was organizing second lines and creating one of the most iconic second lines that would roll through the city, the Big Nine, coming out of the Ninth Ward, across the bridge, back into the downtown area of New Orleans. Yeah, he's going to get a second line. And that's the main thing that's been so painful, is not to, you know, give him the kind of passage that he deserves.
Bruce Sunpie Barnes, thanks for your insights. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And don't hit the female. Now, the females can cooperate with this and kind of push it along by, when everything is going fine, when you first meet this fella that you think you really like and you're going to start spending some time with him, and when you all are sitting somewhere with the candlelight and roses, if that's the setting, or wherever, in the apartment, in the car, and you're really talking about how much you really go for each other and all the rest of that stuff that you half believe, okay? The female should speak up and say, "Johnny, I want to tell you something that's very, 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 very important to me. And we've been seeing each other about a month now. Don't ever hit me." Now, if you hit me, there's nothing I can do because you're much bigger than me, you're muscular, you play basketball and all like this. But don't ever hit me, because what that will mean is that we can never be together again.
Millions of Americans in much of the country have been under stay-at-home orders for a month to limit the spread of the coronavirus. It's ideal for nobody, and for some people, it's terrifying and dangerous. It means being locked down with somebody who beats and abuses them. Reports of domestic violence have risen in recent weeks. Suzanne DeBuse is CEO of the Jeannie Geiger Crisis Center, which is just north of Boston. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You closed your center down and began to do remote work, I gather, in the middle of March. Are you able to hear from victims of domestic violence? What do they say?
Yeah, it was a scary time to shut down, because we knew that survivors were really struggling with the issues of abuse already, and to feel that we were closing off some resources was really painful, but we also knew that we needed to do this. And what we found was, during the first couple of weeks, actually, people weren't contacting us, and it really felt like all of us, that people were just trying to figure out, you know, what does this mean for my life? How do I get situated? How am I dealing with kids being home all the time? But we assumed that once that happened, that we would start to hear from survivors again, and that has happened.
Was that 2 weeks of silence kind of a bad sign that people were trying to live with the abuse?
Yes. Well, survivors have started to kind of come back to us at the same levels that they were before. So they're attending support groups, they're calling the hotlines, they're meeting with their advocates, their counselors, their lawyers. While that's happening, a number of new clients reaching out to us is much smaller than it has been. And when they are reaching out, the domestic violence has been escalating, or they are in really kind of severe states of trauma and stress and fear. And so it takes a lot to try to figure out what's the next best step.
I mean, I'm trying to account for all the factors that could aggravate this. You have stress, at high levels. You have job loss. You have the fact that some abusers must think there's less chance that they'll get caught. The people who are victims of abuse aren't seeing their friends and able to talk outside the home.
You're absolutely right. And domestic violence is predicated on power and control. And so when the abuser uses controlling tactics to have power in the relationship, to mete out abuse, then coronavirus becomes a tactic. And so they can keep children. So rather than return children after a supervised visitation or a weekend at dad's house, they can say, you know what, I don't think your mom's doing a good enough job social distancing. And when I saw her, she wasn't wearing a mask, so you're not going to go home. And, you know, that's one way that abusers can continue to, I think, take advantage of an already stressful situation to gain even more control.
Ms. Dubuse, I'm told this is something you know firsthand.
Yes. When I was married, we lived on the top of this mountaintop in this seasonal community. And my husband would, you know, abuse me and then take the car and drive and leave me alone with no phone in the top of this mountain. And so afraid of everything around me. Yeah. And I was thinking, I can understand what people are feeling like who are trapped at home right now.
Something you can say to them?
Yes, that they're not alone. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's probably most important for survivors and victims who are living at home with their abusers to know is that they can find a way. So whether they're taking a shower, or able to go to the grocery store or to the drugstore and to quickly connect with a friend. And also, if you're a friend who has someone that you're worried about in your life, then see if there's any way that you can extend yourself so that they know if things get worse, that you're a person that can be contacted.
Suzanne Dubuse is the CEO of the Jeannie Geiger Crisis Center near Boston. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Want some bacon?
No, man. I don't eat pork.
Are you Jewish?
No, I ain't Jewish. I just don't dig on swine. That's all.
Why not?
Pigs are filthy animals. I don't eat filthy animals.
Yeah, but bacon tastes good. Pork chops taste good.
Hey, sewer rat may taste like pumpkin pie, but I'd never know because I wouldn't eat the filthy motherfuckers. Pigs sleep and root and shit. That's a filthy animal. I ain't eating nothing. Ain't got sense enough to disregard its own feces.
The coronavirus outbreak is upending the country's food supply chain. Orchards, farms, and dairies continue to produce fruit, vegetables, and milk that farmers cannot sell. So they're actually dumping perfectly good food. And at the same time, one meat producer is warning about a shortage of certain meats, like pork. Here to help us make sense of all this is NPR's Dan Charles. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Elsa.
So this meat producer that we're mentioning is Smithfield Foods, and just yesterday it shut down a big pork plant in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Tell us what happened.
They had more than 300 cases, positive cases of coronavirus among the workers at that plant. Actually, more than a third of all the coronavirus cases in the entire state of South Dakota are among the workers at that plant.
Wow.
Smithfield had said it would stop operating for 3 days just to clean the plant, but the mayor of Sioux Falls, Paul Ten Haken, really put pressure on. He released a letter on Saturday calling on the company to shut it down for much longer. I talked with him today.
It was tense. You know, it was tense because they're the third largest pork producer in the country, this plant. You know, you shut down a plant like that, it has a pretty big impact on the food supply.
So Smithfield announced yesterday that they are shutting it down indefinitely. The company did not sound happy about it. The company's CEO, Kenneth Sullivan, put out a statement saying that closing facilities like this, quote, is pushing our country perilously close to the edge in terms of our meat supply.
Is that a fair characterization? Are things really that dire?
It is not really quite right. There are actually two different things going on here. So you have a production bottleneck when a big processing plant like this goes down. And it's not the only one. I mean, right now, about 5% of the country's pork processing capacity is shut down. And this is a big deal for the farmers who supply those plants. They suddenly have no place to send their hogs. But on the other side of that bottleneck, on the consumer side, there is not really a shortage of pork. In fact, in some places, we have the opposite problem, Elsa. Too much pork, or at least too much of the wrong kind of pork. Too much bacon, Elsa.
Oh, that's about a good problem, 60, I suppose.
60% of all the bacon in the country goes to what's called food service. That's places like cafeterias or restaurants that serve eggs and bacon for breakfast or bacon cheeseburgers at lunch. And those food service places, they're shut down, and people are not buying nearly as much bacon when they eat at home. So pork processors have all this bacon and nowhere to sell it.
Hmm. Well, people are eating at home a lot more now. I mean, for basically every meal, which sounds like would be a huge shift for the food industry. I mean, how is the industry handling that change?
It is a huge shift, a seismic shift. It's throwing supply chains into chaos. Milk is not going to schools anymore. There's not as much cheese going to pizza restaurants. You have farmers just dumping milk that they cannot sell, millions of gallons every day. Similar things are happening with fresh produce. I talked with vegetable farmers in Florida who've been abandoning fields of squash and cucumbers and tomatoes because they cannot find a buyer for that fresh produce.
What a waste. Does anyone have ideas on how to fix the problem?
Well, you can do it. I mean, the food can be shifted, but it's not always easy. Food companies are working hard to figure out how to do this. Sometimes they have to package it differently to sell it in the kind of packaging that we're used to in the grocery stores. In fact, consumers may start seeing food that isn't packaged quite in the same way. I talked to an industry analyst who said, you know, for example, with chicken, we may start seeing more whole chickens and not so many of the different chicken parts that we're used to, which take more labor to cut up. Basically, you know, when there's less labor available in the processing plants, we may have to do a little more labor at home.
That is NPR's Dan Charles. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
And we've almost lost Detroit. This time, how would we ever get over losing our mind?
Dr. Abdullah Sayed, I want to bring into the conversation another guest as we turn to another major issue in the city of Detroit facing amidst the coronavirus pandemic, the water shutoffs. Despite the city announcing a moratorium on water shutoffs and a program to help thousands of residents restore service last month, people in Detroit are still reporting lack of access to water and even ongoing shutoffs. This is a video posted by Detroit resident Motisala Rayon, Facebook, 2 weeks ago.
So the water department is out here to turn the water off at this home across the street. Mind you, in the middle of a pandemic, they're here to turn the water off. And this is a family with an infant child. She has two children.
So more than 140,000 homes in Detroit have had their water shut off since 2014, according to a local news outlet, The Bridge. As of March 31st, the city had only restored water to 1,000 of the 10,000 people who called to report issues with their water. We're now joined by the community pastor, activist Reverend Razan Bouye. She's frontline practitioner, executive director of Brightmoor Connection Food Pantry in Detroit. You are very hard to get a hold of, Reverend, because you are so busy out there getting water to people. Can you explain for people in the rest of the country who might not understand, people have had their water cut off, and even though the city has said they won't be doing it anymore, there are many people who still don't have access to water when the first thing we're told in this pandemic is you must continually wash your hands?
Yes, that's true. So here in Detroit, the water is still not on. I just need to open with that and say that folks are still experiencing water insecurity. No one still has water. The city has historically, since 2014, turned off over 140,000. And so now the city is saying they've turned on 1,200 households. That is nothing in comparison to what is needed. I'm seeing folks every day whose water is off, and folks just as the video that you just showed, are still being shut off from water. And then I need to say, Dr. Saeed made a strong point when he said that COVID-19 follows the path of insecurity. And when your water is shut off, right, when you have no access to clean, affordable water, then that's going to be the community that's hit the hardest. Brightmoor is in the northwest section of Detroit. It has the highest population of water shutoffs. Brightmoor also has the highest population of infant mortality deaths in the womb and out of the womb and due to water insecurity. We know that folks normally who would work every day, right? Because when your water's shut off, you look just like you and I. People go to work, they go to school. So folks have the ability to use restrooms and wash up and get water all day for 8 to 10 hours while they're outside of the home. The children have the ability to do that. But when your water's shut off and we are given the directive to shelter in, which I need to say here and stop for a moment and say, we should stop using that word shelter because we're not using that word correctly. Shelter is defined as having a place of safety and comfort and protection. And when you don't have water on, that's not shelter. It's not shelter when children have to take their waste outside and throw it in the garbage. It's not shelter when you don't have water in your home and the sanitation is not available because the city had declared that laundromats were non-essential providers, so laundromats were closed up as well. So when we see the water shutoff situation, and we understand that contrary to what you're hearing on the news, and I know that the mayor just recently did a statement saying that he had turned everybody back on, that there were only maybe 50 folks left to turn back on, we know that is not to be the truth. And we just really need the truth to get out. And the truth is that folks are still experiencing water insecurity. Folks do not have water. And people are still being shut off from water, right?
Let me ask Dr. Abdul Saeed. You were former director of the Detroit Health Department at the time this started. How can you see this ending? Are you calling for the restoration of water to all the residents of Detroit?
Absolutely. So I started at the city after this policy had already started. It was one of the most frustrating policies to get to city leadership and to the water department and say that public health starts with water. Public health started the moment we figured out how to make sure that people's water was clean. And the fact that we don't have clean water, as the Reverend rightly points out, what does it mean to tell somebody to stay at home and then to wash their hands with warm, soapy water for 20 minutes when they don't have running water in their home? It is absurd in the context of a pandemic. It is absurd even before the pandemic started.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Dr. Abdul Saeed, physician, epidemiologist, former director of the Detroit Health Department, and Reverend Rosalind Bouye, community pastor, executive director of Brightmoor Connection Food Pantry in Detroit.
You heard that I was hospitalized. It is not true. In fact, I haven't been up medical for about a month.
Oh wow!
Which is rare for me because I usually go up 3 times a week to take a bath. But because of this coronavirus and the emergency situation, you know, the only place I've been is to the library, to the yard every 3 days, and on the block right here. But I have not been hospitalized. I don't know where that report comes from. It is not true. Yeah, so. I'm okay, all right?
Yes.
I thank you guys for caring about me and checking on me, but I am well. I need is freedom.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what we're searching for, Mumia. You know, we told you, John Apsa got your back, and anything we hear, we jumping on it. We're going to let these people know that we got your back, and we watching it, even if it's false, so that they know not to step out of line.
That's
so
right.
Happy to hear that you are okay.
That.
We love you.
We love you, yes.
I know. Well, it's good to be heard. Thank you all. Thank all of y'all, you know, for touching base for me and caring, for real.
That's right.
That means more to me than you know.
That's
yes,
right. Oh,
yes,
we
sir.
Know. Oh, we know. You know, Mumia, we know.
We got your back.
That's right. I just heard tonight, about a half hour ago, that a brother named Sutton was down Phoenix, and he was fighting for 30 years, right, to get out of prison based on his innocence. He just died of coronavirus.
Oh, no.
And he never made it home.
That's true.
The state system, as I said in a recent commentary, everybody's locked down. And you get 23 hours in the cell. And then that last 24th hour, 45 minutes out of the cell. You can take a shower. You can get a bucket and swab your decks and mop your cell. Or you can call people on the phone, or you can plug up your tablet to the kiosk. But you're not leaving the block. And they only started yard about a week ago. And that's one, like, 45-minute period every 3 days. I mean, it's insane, right? So everybody in the state is locked down, just like everybody in the United States is locked down. Mm. We are really in prison nation now.
That's right. Mm.
People are incarcerated, and the bars are the fear of, getting ill, and getting sick, and dying.
That's right.
Go to the bar.
That's right.
So, people got to be careful. It's real. And people need to be very, very careful and, take care of themselves. And, and I think really what they need to do is appreciate the people that love them in their families, because you're spending all day, for weeks and months now with your family. You got to make the best of that, because, your family are your people. So, it might be a pain in the ass, but make the best of it. All right?
Yes, sir.
That's the situation.
More than 30 inmates have died in state custody in Mississippi since the end of last year. The state is facing lawsuits in a federal investigation into rampant violence, decrepit conditions, and a culture of neglect and corruption that's plagued Mississippi prisons for decades. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
At the end of a workday, Cheryl Porter pulls into the gravel drive of her one-bedroom travel trailer in Brandon, Mississippi.
Whew. I actually want to get rid of this one and get a bigger one. Because, when Michael gets home, Lord willing.
Michael, her 29-year-old son, has been incarcerated since he was a teenager on several felony charges, including burglary. He's due for release in 2022.
If he gets to come home alive.
Her son was in the Mississippi State Penitentiary at Parchman when deadly riots broke out at the end of last year. She has cell phone images of the aftermath.
It was a bloodbath. I mean, it was horrible. That's the back of my son. This is where they hit him with the pipe. They stabbed him 12 times.
Michael has received death threats, she says, and lives in constant fear.
There's no officers in sight. Inmates is killing each other. Why?
Because the state is in an incarceration crisis, says Alicia Judkins, Mississippi State Director for Forward U.S., a criminal justice advocacy group. She blames chronic underfunding and sentencing laws that have left the system overcrowded, understaffed, and in a state of disrepair.
Because of the sheer number of people in the state's care and custody, they cannot safely house or manage the population that they have.
Since December 29th, more than 30 inmates have died in custody. Some are attributed to gang violence. Others are reported as suicide or illnesses. The uptick in deaths has drawn national attention, along with the ability of inmates to use contraband cell phones to share dramatic video from inside the lockups, like this smoke-filled scene.
We need some help, man. Man, we got a whole fire in the zone, man. The police want you to come in here and get us out of here, bro.
The U.S. Justice Department has opened an investigation, and inmates are suing in a class action, the latest in a string of lawsuits dating to the 1970s that have sought to address inhumane conditions in Mississippi prisons, some of which resulted in federal control of the system over the years. The Mississippi Department of Corrections declined to comment, and Republican Governor Tate Reeves was unavailable for an interview with NPR. But as the crisis worsened shortly after he took office in January, Reeves acknowledged problems.
We're working to improve the conditions there. In a lot of places, they're not good. There's no other word for it. They're terrible.
The state took immediate steps to move some inmates out of what was considered the worst housing unit at Parchman and move nonviolent offenders to other prisons. But amid the coronavirus pandemic, transfers were halted. Advocates are calling for high-risk inmates to be released. They say inadequate medical care and unsanitary conditions make prisoners vulnerable, especially at Parchman, where health inspections detail the lack of clean water and power in numerous cells. The notorious state penitentiary at Parchman has long been a focal point for prison reform. It's a sprawling 18,000-acre working farm in the Mississippi Delta, a former plantation converted to a prison to lease convicts after the Civil War.
I'm an old Parchman doctor, work all the world.
Folklorist Alan Lomax made these field recordings of prisoners working in the fields in the 1940s. Democratic State Representative Robert Johnson of Natchez is the minority leader in the Mississippi House.
Mississippi prisons have always had a history of existing on the backs of human capital.
He remembers when Parchman operated as its own entity with industries and a working farm.
Somebody was making a ton of money on people working for nothing. For African Americans in this state, it feels like a continuation of slavery, really. You lock people up, put them up there, and you put them to work for nothing. That's what it feels like.
There are no chain gangs at Parchman today. Critics say the bondage is now in the form of gang leaders and the corrupt guards who help them. On January 26th, the Mississippi Department of Corrections sent out a news release that 26-year-old Joshua Norman had been found dead on a Sunday morning, hanging in his one-man cell at Parchman.
Supposedly, he committed suicide. You know, I don't believe that happened to him.
Janice Sherman is Joshua's aunt. She says he'd been running from violence and brutality since he first entered the Mississippi Department of Corrections at age 16.
He had no idea, you know, the trauma that awaited him. It's just a very sad story.
He wrote to her that a gang was pressuring him to stab another inmate, but he was resisting and had been beaten.
And then we'd gotten some text messages even a few months ago saying that, you know, he got beaten pretty bad and they were after him, and so if he did commit suicide, he may have been under duress to do it. So, you know, they're just unanswered questions.
She's looking for accountability.
You know, we can't do anything to bring him back, but there are lots of people's, you know, sons and grandsons that are still in there. I'd love to see it be a little bit more safe. You know, it's like you can't live every day knowing that you might die the same day.
Sherman says a prison sentence should not be a death sentence. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Jackson, Mississippi.
Welcome to Atlanta, where the players play, and we ride on the things like every day. Big beats hit the streets, see gangsters roaming, and parties don't stop till 8 in the morning.
Welcome to Atlanta, where the players play, and we ride on the things like every day. Big beats hit the streets, see gangsters roaming, and parties don't stop till 8 in the morning.
Now the party don't start.
The national numbers of sick and dead are staggering. In the U.S., it is over 600,000 who are sick and 24,000 who have died. One city that's been especially hard hit by the illness is Atlanta, Georgia. It's a city that's home to the headquarters of major companies and, at least during normal times, a city that teems with arts, music, and sports. Keisha Lance Bottoms is the city's mayor, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me today.
So you were one of the early ones. I mean, you started limiting gatherings and you issued a stay-at-home order for Atlanta weeks before the governor of your state did. Can you just walk me through the conversations you had to make that decision? Like, did you consult with mayors of other comparable cities, the heads of public schools? How did that work?
So I meet quarterly with a group of CEOs in Atlanta. They're heads of Fortune 500 companies throughout the city. Invited to our quarterly meeting was Dr. Carlos Del Rio from Emory University, one of the leading infectious disease experts in the nation. And he essentially shared with us that we had a 24 to 48 hour window that we needed to close things down. And I left there in a state of shock, but I knew that we needed to move quickly, and we did. And the great part about that, having the CEOs in the room with me to hear the download that I received was helpful because many of our major companies shut down that day.
Well, when do you see Atlanta businesses reopening? I mean, what are the benchmarks that you want to hit before a reopening happens?
Just as I listen and follow the science, when I receive that download from Dr. Carlos Del Rio, I will listen and follow the science as it relates to when we should reopen our city. I think the biggest mistake that we can make is to be so eager to get things back to normal that we put people's lives in jeopardy. And so I am certain it won't be before the beginning of May. Atlanta has some of the highest asthma rates in the country. And I have four children in my household who are asthmatic. And so you think about a large African-American population with many of the underlying conditions that have proven to be deadly for people who are stricken with COVID-19. It is most important that we take our time and we be thoughtful.
Well, how are you working to help the Black community there stay healthy in terms of social distancing, making that a feasible option for them?
Part of it has been simply educating our communities. I was very disturbed about 2 weeks into this pandemic to ride through an area of town that's primarily African American and poor, and to see that the messaging was not getting out. So I've called upon many of our social influencers, our hip hop community in Atlanta, asking them to help me spread the word. So it's important, obviously, to have conversations on NPR, but it's also important to have those same conversations on Instagram and however people receive their information. But there's still more work to be done. So we've taken down the nets at our basketball courts, but in some more affluent areas, we've had to remove tennis courts. So I think that transcends race. I think the more that we see on television and the more discussions we have on urban radio and on mainstream radio, I think that the messaging is getting out, but it's still more work to be done.
If I could just pivot for a moment here. I mean, this is a national election year, obviously. You are a Democrat. I feel I would be remiss not to ask you this question. Vice President Biden has promised to choose a woman as his running mate. Would you be interested in that job?
You know, I think it's great that he is choosing a woman. And what I've said repeatedly is I want Vice President Biden to choose the person who he thinks will help him best beat Donald Trump in November. And so if it's me, I would be honored. But if it is a green Martian that helps him get over the finish line, then I think that's who he needs to go with.
I do also want to ask you this. A woman named Tara Reid has accused Biden of sexual assault, allegations which the Biden campaign has denied. Does that accusation in any way affect the way you view Biden's candidacy?
No, it does not. You know, now I don't know much about her story or what her accusations are. But what I do know about Joe Biden is that he is a man of high integrity. And I know that he respects women. And so I'm honored that he's our nominee. I know him to be a man of the highest integrity.
Keisha Lance Bottoms is the mayor of Atlanta. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Billie Holiday, I sing you blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. Jasmine Dixon, a Black woman, was the first resident of St. Louis to die from the coronavirus. As of April 12th, 17 St. Louis residents have died of the virus. At least 13 were African American. As St. Louis Public Radio's Andrea Henderson reports, the COVID-19 pandemic is showing just how unequal healthcare is in the city.
When the novel coronavirus began to rapidly spread across the country, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warned people who traveled abroad, the elderly, and people with chronic illnesses to take precautionary measures because they were at greater risk for infection.
I was really concerned and I was really adamant because a lot of the residents that live in North St. Louis have issues already medically.
That's Pam Boyd. She's the alderwoman for the 27th Ward. She was one of the first elected officials to push the coronavirus testing in North St. Louis even before the pandemic became deadly in the city. She says the predominantly black neighborhoods in the city disproportionately trails other areas in the region when it comes to testing because of the lack of adequate medical infrastructure.
We were already behind the eight ball before this hit because of the not having the services in North St. Louis as we needed in the beginning. And when this hit, then it made it worse.
Boyd says on the weekly Board of Aldermen conference calls, she begged city officials for testing sites and supplies to enter North St. Louis because its residents do not have access to a major hospital if they become symptomatic. Many lack primary care physicians. North St. Louis is home to some of the city's highest disease rates. Health administrators in the area say they treat high numbers of patients with diabetes, hypertension, various types of cancer, asthma, and heart disease. All these conditions make a person vulnerable to COVID-19. For primary care services, North St. Louis residents rely on federally qualified health centers. Two of the three, Affinia Healthcare and Care STL Health, are now testing centers. But they started testing patients for coronavirus 2 weeks after the region received its first testing site.
When I read about testing in South St. Louis and South County and even North County, people did not even realize they missed North St. Louis. And it was very painful to know that they missed a community.
That's Care STL Health's Chief Executive Officer, Angela Claiborne. She says being weeks behind in testing makes it hard for health officials in North St. Louis to contain the virus in their area.
We're already at risk for being impacted more than other races by chronic disease, diabetes, high blood pressure. Everybody knows that. And so that's why this is such a crisis.
Claiborne says fighting against the pandemic is her priority now, but people in North St. Louis are fighting other problems as well.
I mean, we're in the middle of COVID-19, but we're still fighting the opiate epidemic. We're still fighting the crack epidemic. It has not disappeared.
Homelessness is also another social issue Claiborne says is plaguing her community. And she's concerned about the population because people who are unhoused cannot practice social distancing. The city started releasing COVID-19 cases by zip code in early April. The zip code 63115 had more than 70 cases, the highest number in the city. John Collins Muhammad is the alderman of the 21st Ward. He says this crisis did not just expose the health disparities that already existed in the zip code he represents, 63115, but it also unmasked the years of other inequities the community has endured. Though many North St. Louis leaders believe city officials left their communities out of the COVID-19 plan, the city's health director, Dr. Fred Eccles, says that is not the case because resources are scarce for the entire city.
Know that conditions or illnesses are introduced into a community when it makes its way to those communities that are economically disenfranchised, at high levels of poverty, the health outcomes are typically worse. And so we wanted to make sure that we did our best to provide equitable access to COVID-19 testing.
Eccles says that equitable access was divided between Affinity and Care STL, and his department is working to add more locations. However, after a week of testing, Care STL's CEO was advised to scale back because the city does not have enough kits to give the center. Care STL's first batch of testing kits were donated by local health systems. The city agreed to send 2,500 kits, but Claiborne has only seen 1,000 of those. Care STL Health has two testing sites in North St. Louis, both in jeopardy without additional testing kits. I'm Andrea Henderson, St. Louis Public Radio.
It's April 12th, Easter Sunday. Back on March 24th, President Trump said he'd like the country opened up and raring to go by today, but that point is still a ways away. The coronavirus is still spreading. Americans are still dying, more than 20,000 so far. And public health officials say that while we're approaching the peak of the outbreak in some states, we're not there yet. Meanwhile, unemployment is reaching Great Depression levels. Food banks around the country are overwhelmed with hungry families waiting in their cars for hours, the lines stretching for miles in some places. The virus has hit minority and low-income communities the hardest. One place where that's evident is Michigan. In fact, the state has created a task force to focus specifically on racial disparities in the pandemic's impact. That task force is chaired by Michigan's Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist, and he joins us now from Detroit. Lieutenant Governor, thanks for joining us on this Easter Sunday.
Tom, thank you for having me, and happy Easter to all the listeners who celebrate it.
Same to you, and I hope you and your family are doing well.
We are. We're doing okay. I mean, I have to admit, this has hit the state of Michigan very hard, and my hometown of Detroit in particular. I mean, on a personal level, I have lost 15 people in my life to COVID-19 and have a number of others in my life who are positive or who are quarantined or some who are hospitalized in the extended part of my family. So we're all working to get through this together, and we have to coordinate and stick together in order to make it work.
Well, we're sorry to hear that that has hit you in particular so hard. And of course, the epicenter of the outbreak in Michigan is Detroit. Across the city, how bad is the situation there right now, Lieutenant Governor?
Well, I think people are quite anxious. You know, we took aggressive action through Governor Gretchen Whitmer and I by issuing a stay at home, stay safe order. And so certainly people are working hard to mind that, but it's difficult. I think in particularly in communities like Detroit, in Black communities and communities of color, when things get tough and when there is a high anxiety moment, we often come together to cope with it. And what is particularly dangerous about COVID-19 is that coming together is what puts people at great risk of infection and possibly death. So it's caused people to try to invent new mechanisms for coping. And I think that everyone's just really trying to struggle to get through it.
And this task force that you're directing, Lieutenant Governor Gilchrist, on racial disparities, what have you been able to figure out or learn so far about the disparity of impact in your city?
Well, the state of Michigan was one of the first states to report out COVID-19 test results and deaths by race. And what we have observed is that while Black people make up 14% of the state of Michigan's population, we have accounted for 40% of the deaths. And so clearly there is something going on with the mortality rate and when it comes to Black people. And so the task force is looking to find ways to intervene and to respond to that mortality rate directly in the context of COVID-19. But also recognizing that there are a number of factors that have contributed to poorer health outcomes in communities that are fighting poverty or in communities of color across the state for a long time. Things like social determinants of health, poverty, lack of consistent access to the healthcare system, having to do things in the context of this virus, like take public transit to get to your critical infrastructure job.
Well, what are some of the things that you can do? I mean, given those environmental and kind of structural factors, you know, what kind of mitigation is possible?
I think there are several things that are possible. First is making sure that we have as clear of understanding of the problem by data sharing and information sharing. There perhaps are particular interventions that can be taken to protect people who are riding public transportation in order to get to work or to get to critical resources like groceries. I will say that one thing that is going to be critical in our interventions and frankly in getting ahead of this pandemic for the entirety of our population is more access to testing resources. We're testing more and more people every day, but we probably may need to have specific testing strategies for communities of color and particularly Black communities in densely populated places like Detroit. We're going to need more so that we can truly have a sense of the community spread.
Now, finally, the mayor of Detroit, Mike Duggan, spoke a few days ago about the tough days ahead and losing neighbors to the virus. But he also said there were glimmers of hope that social distancing may actually be working. Do you share that optimism?
Well, I share a confidence in the people of the state of Michigan, certainly, and the people are working as hard as they can and doing the best they can. Those who are able to stay home are indeed staying home and staying safe. And there has been some evidence that the policy is working, but it's not over. We are still, we believe, according to our models, some time away from the peak of this infection and the death here in the state of Michigan. And so that is why we're trying to do everything we can to not only slow the spread, but decrease the mortality rate, and particularly decrease that mortality rate in places that are hit most hard and amongst the populations that are hit most hard, which right now is Black people in the state of Michigan.
Well, that's Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist of Michigan. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Lieutenant Governor. Good luck to you and take care.
Tom, thank you for having me. Stay home, stay safe, everyone. We'll save lives.
This question, why is this stuff happening? The New York Times editorial today, the Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 1210-2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, it's, I mean, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
Far-right militias and members of something called the Patriot Movement are calling on their followers to openly defy government-enforced COVID-19 restrictions. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports from Idaho.
Ammon Bundy, who led an armed occupation of a federal wildlife refuge in Oregon in 2016 and was later acquitted, hasn't drawn much attention from the news cameras or social media until COVID-19. In defiance of Idaho's stay-at-home order, he's been holding regular in-person meetings in Emmett, a farming town in a river valley near the Oregon border. Bundy wears his cowboy hat and jeans and addresses a couple dozen people while glancing at his notes on his MacBook.
Actually, if it gets bad enough and our rights are infringed upon enough that we physically stand in defense in whatever way we need to.
In Facebook live streams, he often strikes a similar tone as his father, Cliven Bundy, did in the days leading up to an armed standoff near the family's Nevada ranch. Ammon Bundy had pledged to hold non-denominational Easter services yesterday for 1,000 people here. A much smaller crowd turned up at a warehouse he owns in a dusty lot by the Emmett railroad tracks.
You guys can park right here.
One activist played the shofar, an adopted symbol of the Patriot Movement. I watched from across the road.
Since I've been here, it looks like maybe a few dozen people have been coming in. American flags on pickups, bumper stickers saying things like taxation is theft. There's one over there promoting the conspiracy theory website InfoWars. People are hugging. They seem to know each other. I don't see anyone wearing masks.
Even in Idaho, one of the nation's most conservative states, all of this might have been dismissed as bluster, were it not for the fact that several elected officials here in the rural Northwest are making similar calls as Bundy.
Quite frankly, I don't know why Idaho is falling in line with some of the most liberal governors across this nation.
One of the most vocal is Republican legislator Heather Scott in the Northern Idaho Panhandle. It's a region long associated with far-right extremism, both imported and homegrown. On her YouTube channel, Scott blames what she says is the lying, Trump-hating media for spreading unfounded fear about the coronavirus. The local sheriff there in Bonner County urged Idaho's Republican governor, Brad Little, to convene the legislature to rescind the order. Now, the governor and his attorney general, who declined interview requests, say their policy is constitutional. Oregon sociologist Randy Blazak studies far-right extremists in the Pacific Northwest.
They're really focusing on how this might be an opportunity to advance their very extremist views.
While there have been hundreds of cases in Blaine County, Idaho, and on Western Indian reservations, Blazak says there haven't been many reported infections in most rural areas.
The people in rural America don't quite see the real body count. And so it's very easy for them to deny the severity of this virus.
Health officials say it's dangerous to cast doubt on stay-at-home orders, one of the only real tools to stop the spread of COVID-19 until a vaccine is available. Dr. Morgan Morton is the chief of staff at Bonner General Hospital in the county where the sheriff says businesses should reopen and people should be free to move about.
I think it's a minority of people, and these people have gotten into office. I'm not exactly sure how, but there are a lot of normal, level-headed people here, and I just hope that they're listening to us and not to them.
Morton says her 25-bed hospital has just 4 ventilators and could easily get overwhelmed if the disease keeps spreading. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Boise.
We begin in the U.S., where President Trump has appeared to endorse protests against lockdown measures in several U.S. states in a series of tweets urging people to liberate themselves. This comes 24 hours after he told state governors across the U.S. to call their own shots on when and how to reopen their economies. He now appears to support protests against lockdown measures. The tweets followed mainly right-wing protests in several states calling on governors to relax stay-at-home orders so they can resume their normal activities. Our North America correspondent Jane O'Brien told me more.
He told protesters in 3 states, Minnesota, Michigan and Virginia, to liberate their states, implying that the lockdown orders, the orders to stay at home, were somehow infringing on their freedoms. I think it's important to mention that the protests themselves that we've seen over the last few days haven't been that big. They've only been a few hundred strong, but they're certainly vociferous, and they do represent the core of Donald Trump's base, a base that he's going to need in the upcoming election. So there's definitely an element of deep politicking going on, which has surprised a lot of people at a time when there is a national crisis on the scale of the coronavirus. Jay Inslee, who's a Democratic governor in Washington state, actually accused the president of fomenting domestic rebellion.
But the president appears to have contradicted himself.
Well, as you say, this comes 24 hours after he issued his own set of guidelines, urging states not to lift restrictions until there's been 14 days of a drop in the number of new cases and that hospitals can cope, urging that this should be done slowly and that governors should be able to dictate their own pace. But then telling or implying that these Democratic governors should act faster. He also took on Andrew Cuomo, who's the governor of New York, which is the epicenter of the outbreak, saying that Governor Cuomo was talking too much and not doing enough. This was an exchange that took place in real time with Governor Cuomo at his own press conference, saying that perhaps the president should watch less television and get to work himself.
The polls and what they show on the issues of the economy and health are interesting, though.
Very interesting. It's very clear that at the moment, Americans want a president who has the best recovery plan. And President Trump and the presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden are tied on this issue. But they also don't want restrictions lifted too early in order to help the economy. They are quite clearly prioritizing health over the economy, and that goes for both parties. There are slightly more Republicans who favor ending shelter-in-place orders quicker, but the vast majority of Americans seem to be embracing the measures that are now in place.
Jane O'Brien.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, April 18, 2020, so I have been told. Our weekly compensatory call-in, dial-in if you have thoughts, observations, questions, suggestions, the number 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Many things before we get to callers. First of all, we will be here tomorrow. Seems like we have been super active during the pandemic. I hope we have not just been wasting people's time and energy. We have lots of serious problems all over the world. So just because, well, we have a lot of essential workers, so it's not like we have a huge listening audience of folks who have just had their feet propped up at home for the last month and, you know, getting DoorDash and Uber Eats. I don't think the Cows listening audience is comprised of that demographic. A lot of essential workers calling to participate in workplace racism. But even still, I think we've had folks who, you don't have as many options, you know. It's no basketball, no NBA playoffs, no March Madness and that sort of thing. Can't go hanging out on a Saturday evening. It's springtime, you know. It's all warm and such, and you can't do all that. So hopefully people are not captive and listening to the Cows, wasting time and energy. Hopefully if you are tuning in, have been listening throughout all of this with the coronavirus, that it has been informative, constructive, worthy of your time and energy. That said, we have been on a lot, and we will be here tomorrow. Global Sunday Talk on Racism, White Supremacy. I was so thankful we were able to do this program last month, and then able to come back and do it again this time around. Just kind of check in. We heard from folks in Austria and the UK, South Korea, different locations, and to be able to hear a month later what's their experience, what's their observation. Things have changed drastically since we spoke with them. So just to be able to check back in again, I think it'll be awesome. Looking forward to chatting with them. This is, you know, everything about this is rife with confusion and stress. So being able to talk to folks in different parts of the world to get more information, try to get a better understanding, I think is helpful in a lot of ways. So tomorrow, Global Sunday Talk, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. We will chat it up. We'll also be here this coming Wednesday, Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington. She wrote Packing Them In about environmental racism in Chicago. We just finished it in the book club. She will be here on Wednesday, Earth Day, back to normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Super looking forward to talking to Miss Dr. Hood this coming Wednesday. Next on the list, man, oh man, with great, tremendous displeasure, the Cows Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat for Toronto is canceled. There's absolutely nothing that can be done to salvage this one for 2020. I thought, oh, at minimum, maybe we could reschedule, or we could do it someplace else. They have extended the closure with the U.S. Canada border for another 30 days, and in fact, what let me know, that was the coup de grace. Specifically, it wasn't just that they extended the closure of the Canada-USA border for another 30 days, which would still be short of the date for the retreat, but it's going to remain closed even after that, and we don't know when. That was when, yep, this is going to be a total flush because, yeah, you can't even pick a date in the future and say, well, I think it'll be open by here. And the other side, there's so many other sides to that where it's like, yep, this is a total done deal. Man. Anyway, we'll see if we can go about it. It should be very easy to recoup the funds because we had already done all of the work. And when I say all of the work, the menu had been created. The place where we were going to stay had been paid in full, like super well-organized retreat, all in the trash for the Rona. Anywho, we should be able to recoup the funds for the Airbnb, I think, pretty easily. They had a nice COVID policy, so hopefully that'll be super easy and be super easy to do our refunds. And oh well. Maybe we'll be able to get to Toronto some point down the road, but that is not going to happen this year at all. No chance. We also were scheduled for Washington, D.C., and already had people that were paid up for Washington, D.C. Now, that one seems like it could be feasible. I am not sure. Want to make sure we're being, you know, responsible with everything, but it seems likely that things would be moving about like it wouldn't be impossible to get to Washington, D.C. That wouldn't require going across the border and all the rest of it. But I'm not entirely sure. We'll have to wait a few weeks and see if that's feasible at all. But it is, man, appallingly challenging to attempt to plan for much of anything. You can't even adequately plan to have toilet paper for something. So just have to take it a day at a time and see what's what with D.C., if that is feasible, although it seems like it should be. If white people are out in the streets being defiant and protesting stay-at-home orders now, it would seem like they would probably have guns holstered and, you know, be ready to get raw and go after President Obama or somebody if, you know, we were still required to be shelled up in the House by August. So I do want to make sure I get in one comment. I am so appalled at what a terrible job white people have done at handling all of this in this part of the world. South Korea, Japan, they did their lockdown. They're done. Things have moved on. People are back on the subway, crowding and elbowing everybody and all of that. They moved on. We are still twiddling around, trying to figure it out. Can't get toilet paper. It's been absolutely embarrassing. Just in comparison, like what the response could be to dealing with all of this and what we have had. Incidentally, I have had people who have said, hey, with all of your moping and complaining about things, talking about me, Gusty, you are lucky to be in Seattle for all of this. You could be, you know, in God off of Detroit and have no water. Or you could be in New York with all of this and, you know, mass graves at Potter's Field and all the rest of it. You know, they took it pretty serious out in Seattle and are talking about opening things back up safely. I reckon. Let's see. Other things before we get to the folks who called in. I guess they could be worst places to be dealing with all of this, I reckon. The segment on Ron Lewis, Louisiana, that also sounds like it would be a horrible place to be for all of this. I listened to that segment, and I didn't know how to process it. Now, he's died at the age of 68. Seems like he suffered his entire life having to live in Louisiana, a system of white terrorism. And then he lived through Hurricane Katrina, the levee breach, toxic water. Talk about respiratory problems. Remember that? They didn't call it flood water. We read Katrina After the Flood, Gary Rivlin, book club. Toxic flood water. That's what they call it. All that debris and waste and everything else that was in it. And you think you come out of that and you have no respiratory issues? And then the mold that they were talking about, they got in those structures and everything. And you don't think anybody came through that with no respiratory problems? So Mr. Lewis, he suffers through all this. And this, oh, yeah, he's on dialysis and all the other health problems, diabetes and terrorism from Hurricane Katrina and all the rest of it. Would not surprise me at all if this ends up being somebody that says, oh, yeah, I ended up having some problems with COVID-19. Whether that is the case, whether it's just related to everything that you heard there, does not surprise me at all. That seems very indicative of what I saw in Louisiana. Lots of unhealthy black people before and after Hurricane Katrina. That's what we do in Louisiana. Crank out unhealthy black people that we're going to terrorize and, you know, abuse them. Their children have poor quality air, poor quality housing, all of that. And then I listened to the segment even more. They're talking about Mr. Lewis. Yeah, he was on dialysis. He had a hard time, and, you know, he couldn't get around as well as he used to. All a part of the plan of white supremacy racism. He couldn't get around as well as he used to, so he would come and greet us. And I saw him this year right at Mardi Gras. Oof, big asterisk right there. So he saw him this year at Mardi Gras, and I gave him a big hug. And I said, oh, my God, they killed Mr. Lewis right there, like social distancing, like that hadn't started. And I was thinking, like, oh, yeah, that hadn't started, like this wasn't, you know, a thing by then, which is what people have said, like, oh, man, that's probably why Louisiana and New Orleans specifically has been hit really hard. You had all that hugging and fondling and rubbing for Mardi Gras and dragged people in, particularly a lot of white people from all over, whether they had recently been to China or some of the other spots that they said are so-called hot spots. You drag all those people into New Orleans and have them in super dense quarters and rubbing on everybody and hugging and all the rest of it, and there you go. And then hugging and all the rest of it and bad food and said, yep, I guess there are substantially worse places to be than Seattle to deal with all of this. But that stood out listening to the segment on Mr. Lewis, very sad about his passing. I just thought about all of, like I said, you know, the response and the way that it's been so poorly coordinated, in my opinion. This seems like it would be set up for a lot of people to die. Like if, you know, system of racism, white supremacy, and particularly if you can tailor it so that you get a disproportionate amount of Negros that end up dying, like, oh yeah, have a situation where you keep giving out contradictory information, like wear a mask. Don't wear a mask. Get hand sanitizer. Oh, it's no hand sanitizer. Oh, man, wash your packages and groceries. And then they came out and said, oh, no, that's silly. You don't need to do that. And then they came out and said, well, man, you should leave your packages for 3 days. I said, wait a minute. You just said a week ago that it was nothing on the packages, which it. And then you add into that random whites, race soldiers, hop out. We're defying Patriot Front. This is ridiculous. You add in all of that. You get a whole lot of confusion, very easy for a whole lot of people to die. Could be by plan. Next, let's see. Got confused about my notes. The segment on Atlanta, that was another one. In fact, I can pause right there. We'll definitely remember my place. So I've said, I think last week, reading is more important than watching television. For those folks, while we might have a little extra free time, if you are a student and you don't have to go to school, I know that's the case for some of our listeners. I know we don't have a whole lot of folks who have been working from home, but I know that is applies to some of you. But if you have a little more free time because of all of this, reading is more important than watching television. Let's try to be constructive with our time. I know it can be a little bit difficult to try to plan things for the future, but as best we can to use this time constructively and not just binging it up, watching Netflix and, you know, all the rest of it. And that said, I had meant to ask if anyone had seen anything constructive. I'm sure there has been some viewing. I was not able to contribute to this list. We've been broadcasting a lot, and I haven't watched anything. Like, I was going to even ask somebody, like, is there a Netflix offering where it's not about dead black people? And I didn't even get around to asking because I haven't really had the free time to watch. But I was trying to get prepared. Didn't really have free time this week, but I was working to get prepared. And I finally stumbled upon the Michael Vick documentary that was just released. I was going to say, I don't know if I would necessarily recommend it, but it is a lot about racism. It covers the dogfighting trial and all of that, so it would definitely have to deal with racism. I forgot how much footage they had of white people wanting him to be killed. It seemed like, if my memory, just from remembering all of this, seeing the footage, that Michael Vick was about on par with O.J. Simpson for a long time in terms of most despised black people in the United States. Like, he was right there with O.J. Simpson. Like, I had forgotten the number of times that people just would be on regular television saying that he should be killed, lynched, electrocuted. Like, I had remembered all of that, but I'd forget. It had been, you know, more than 10 years, so I had forgotten. But, I mean, they have no shortage of footage of white people saying, oh, yes, he should be killed, lynched, electric chair, hung, lynched, all of that, repeatedly. His pregnant wife saying, oh, I'm so afraid, my husband, I don't think he'll get black male privilege. They've been talking about killing him, and he should be in the electric chair. It was startling to be reminded of that. But racism is throughout. But one of the things that stood out, and it had counter-racism, it was applicable to counter-racism concepts because Mr. Vick said, and I mean anybody out there that says or thinks that they have a connection to Michael Vick, I was supposed to see this because I've said I was born in Virginia, so, you know, the whole state of Virginia loves Michael Vick and watched his career. I won't say the whole state, but a lot of people, even many race soldiers, you know, were super excited about Michael Vick, the Blacksburg days. You can see it in the documentary as well. But I graduated from the University of Virginia. I have credit on my transcript from Virginia Tech in Blacksburg. Like, I spent a lot of time on that. Like, I knew lots of the locations that they were going to. Oh, there's the dorms, there's the trail field, and blah, 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 and all the rest of it. And then the double whammy is that not only did I get that end, I lived in Atlanta. So I got both ends of, oh, now he's a star here, and blah, 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 and all the rest of it. So I got a lot of enjoyment for a lot of reasons, but racism, white supremacy at the forefront of it. But he said, Mr. Vick, before he's arrested and has to go to jail and all of this, he said that he had family members, and they testified that, oh yeah, this is true, that his fan, not like distant cousins and people that you barely know and all that, I mean like family, people that, you know, you are close to, you trust them, and they've known you your whole life, and, you know, sincere, they are concerned for your well-being, family, what it's supposed to be, right? So he had family who came and said, oh my goodness, I keep hearing all of these reports from people saying that the man is watching your house and that they're looking for illegal activity. What is going on out there? And he just ignored it. So this is family. So that this was one. Then he said they had friends in law enforcement. I don't even know very many people who have friends in law enforcement, but all right. He says he has friends in law enforcement, and they came and they told him, hey, whatever you're doing in that house out there, the man is watching you. You'd better cut that out. Second time he's talking, this time by law enforcement. What they call it, the metaphor, in one ear, out the other. The third time, he says, Mr. Vick, you know, I used to drive into that property in Virginia with the dog kennels and all that, cost me all that $100 million and all that, had to go to jail for 2 years. I used to go into that property and I would see state troopers sitting right across the street. And I thought they were just there to secure the church. I never thought that they were doing surveillance on us. Lots of love for Michael Vick. Not the smartest person. Painful, but not the smartest person in the classroom. I had to mention it for counter-racist purposes because I said, this type of thing happens on a regular basis. You try to share constructive information and people do not listen. This happens with racism, white supremacy. Apparently, this happens with many, many things where people just don't listen. A lot of this is directly attributable to the system of white supremacy, and it's a whole lot of things. Mr. Vick, you know, admitted this. I didn't know this at the time, that he had been told, you know, repeatedly that this was going to all end very badly, and he ignored it. Not a good decision maker, but this does happen repeatedly. If anything, it reminded me about, oh, okay, well, yes. Don't get too frustrated because this happens frequently in the system of white supremacy. It's why you know, sometimes you cannot force information, particularly counter-racist information, on non-white people, because sometimes that just makes it worse. You try to package the information, use words, timing, so that you can make it as palatable as possible, so that they will be as receptive to your message as possible. But man, sharing constructive information in a system of white supremacy apparently is appallingly difficult. He had people that genuinely love him who were telling him years before all of this went bad, ooh, you should do something about that, and he ignored them. Now contrast that with trying to talk to a total stranger that you don't know at all and tell them that the greatest problem in your life is white people. Probably going to be challenging. Anywho, might be worth checking out. I don't know. It's not the best thing I've ever seen. I think I would have probably survived if I had not seen it. But racism, white supremacy is a very dominant element in the film from beginning to end. Racism, how could it not be? Anywho, I'm sure there are better things to do. Reading is more important than watching television. Anyway, they had a sign with MARTA there too, which I always get a giggle about, because that's their rapid transit system, metropolitan area. Oh, I forgot what it stands for. It's an acronym, but what they call it is moving Africans rapidly through Atlanta. That is the racist acronym slur that is used, but that's not what it's for. It's like Metropolitan Atlanta Transportation Rapid Authority or something close to that. Anyway, and it doesn't run very well at all. It's one of the worst public transportation outfits in the country, and it is deliberately bad because of racism. I was hoping that they were going to mention that in the segment where they were talking about Atlanta. That's exactly where I left off in my notes. They were talking to the mayor, black female, in Atlanta, and they were talking about why this is so bad in Atlanta, and immediately the first thing that I thought of, now they mentioned asthma. I don't doubt that for a minute. I strongly suspect that that's true, but the first thing that I thought of, which is directly related to the asthma, all respiratory issues, really, they have horrible air quality in Atlanta. Like, that's one of the few places that I've been. I didn't live in L.A. I visited, but I mean, where they regularly have, like, toxic air warnings, where if you have asthma, if you have respiratory issues, like, oh, man, you better stay in the house. Like, I don't know about the Rona, but, woof, we have got poison in the air today. Be in the house 12 to 1, like right in the super hot parts of the day in the summertime. Like, I remember that. And I've talked to other Cows listeners who noted the same thing. Like, I have not lived too many places, really anywhere that I can think of, where there are, like, regular warnings and advisories about toxic air quality. That's a regular thing. And I'm not surprised, because they have lots of, well, they have lots of black people. So, I mean, hey, I already expect it's going to be poor quality. But the population density, and they have really bad traffic, and all of that is deliberate. They have really bad public transportation, and just, it's designed to be poor quality. The CDC headquarters is there. I feel like it's designed. That's what they do, like toxify and poison black people with bad food and all the rest of it. So I was not surprised to hear any of that, really, about how bad it's been, or we don't know when the restrictions are going to lift. We've got lots of vulnerable populations. Now, when she said the mayor about they went to some of the lower income areas with black people, and it seemed like the message wasn't getting out, the people were still doing things. I said, well, I don't know. I don't know if they've been paying attention to the Patriot Front. I don't know if they've been paying attention to President Trump talked about, let's lift these restrictions, and you're not going to, you know, stomp on my constitutional rights, and I'm going outside if I want to, like, I don't know. Like, it's such a confusing environment to try to get accurate information about what should we be doing, what should we not be doing, are the restrictions about over, can we go back outside? You got a lot of white people who are doing the same thing, so... yeah, I don't know. The main gist of it, I don't doubt the information about Atlanta, the casualties, and how much of an impact it's had there at all. Having lived there, all of that seems very reasonable. We can start and end with exactly what I just said. Very poor quality air. And then everything else that they want to add on, oh yeah, I could see why they would have a lot of problems with this. That would be another location. Seattle or Atlanta. I would much rather take where I am now. Thank you kindly. I remember that. They even said they weren't even taking, that they didn't even have, like, serious guidelines. We had people who called in, I think, a month ago, and they said they were still having, like, shootings out at Lenox Mall. Like, how is the mall still open? Like, the mall has been closed out here for a month. Let's see. Got something on Atlanta. If any of the folks have seen these white people that are actively protesting, I don't know if that's massive. They said it was smaller numbers in Idaho. I don't know if we have large listeners in Idaho, but it does seem like there are more of those types of vocal whites who are on, you know, let's get this reopened and we're trying to get business rolling again, and or the constitutionality of it, that you don't have a right to tell me I have to stay at home and all the rest of it. Like, you tell the sick people and elderly people to stay at home, but everybody else, like, I'm fine, I can go do what I want. If folks have been seeing that, that would be, you know, good to share. I don't know how widespread that is, but it would be difficult for me to imagine a large number of black people going out coordinated either with the threat of guns or actual guns present, saying that, you know, Governor Inslee, Governor Cuomo, Governor, Santorum, the rest of these folks, they're not going to tell Governor Whitmore, they're not going to tell us, they're not going to boss us around. You're not the boss of me. You're not going to tell me I got to stay in the house. It'd be hard for me to imagine a whole lot of black people doing that sort of thing, and them not being arrested, like, immediately. What is it? Black identity extremists. Like, come on. Come on. Let's see. I don't have anything else. I'll pause there. The number again is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes, if you have thoughts, comments to share, that would be awesome. If you have additional questions, commentary to share, if you could pause, allow everybody to allow everyone to have at least one opportunity to speak. And then once everyone has shared once, then if you have additional comments, you should be able to have an additional say. We should have extra time once everyone has spoken. If you know you are in a noisy environment, shouldn't be out at a party or anything like that, but if, you know, the TV is on or whatever it is, if you could try to get to a relatively quiet area so that you can speak, and then use your mute button, that way we don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary background noise, that would be super appreciated, and then you can just unmute yourself when you are ready to speak again. For this program specifically, I request if we could not use metaphors, if we could speak directly to what it is that we want to say. Race soldiers, they use a lot of metaphors to promote confusion, deception. A lot of times they'll mention two separate concepts, and they will say that these are exactly identical. They're twins. And frequently that's not the case at all. Master deception. Victims, myself included, we have been exposed to this misconduct for centuries. Sometimes we're still learning. We don't have all of the logic or evidence to articulate our views, and so sometimes we'll substitute an analogy, metaphor, simile of some sort, and frequently that just contributes to more confusion. If we could be precise, exact about what it is we want to say, would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Thank you kindly. One other thing I did want to make sure that I share. Now, we have read books in the Cows Book Club that I did not particularly like before. We read Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. It has got some competition, but at least for the time being, it is still the worst book ever. Now, for some listeners, they were not pleased about that and felt that they needed to write in their displeasure about me coming to that conclusion. Some people, in what I think is one of the most appalling things that you can do for a book club, to open your mouth to utter one syllable about a book you haven't read. That, I think, is one of the most nauseating, unacceptable things in the world as it relates to a book club, and that happens a lot, and it happened a lot with Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, where people felt however they felt about that book being described accurately, worst book ever. I didn't read it. I haven't listened to it. I don't really know anything about it, but I disagree with what's being said. I am not tolerating that at all with the current book that we are reading, which is right there challenging for the worst book ever. If you like The Nutritional Destruction of Black People, if you think that is an awesome book, if you think it is constructive, if you are all into your Africanality and all of the rest of it spectacular, don't write Gus T. Renegade one sentence. I'm not reading it. I don't care. We're just trying to get through the book. I don't have a PDF of it. I don't have anything to share. It's absolutely gross and disgusting for many reasons that I've already said, and we're so early in it, but certainly do not write me to gripe or complain. If you like it and you think it's great, keep it on your library shelf. Read and share. Much obliged. Number again is 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First few folks dialed in, if you have comments, observations to share, proceed. Let's see. Mm-mm.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
You know, a caller from New Jersey. Matthias Fighter, this one's for you. Have family in Florida. From speaking of confusion, Florida has opened up the beaches. I don't know if that is accurate or not, but those are reports that I've heard. And I'm just, I don't, as of right now, I don't know what to make of that. But other than what you just spoke of, Gus, adding to the confusion. Governor, I mean, Atlanta mayor, was she the black female who was speaking about Joe Biden?
Yes, they got in the tacky okay. commentary at the end. Yes, yes, Mayor Lightfoot, yes.
Oh, that was very tacky. He's a man of high integrity. I thought that the whole Me Too movement was believe her. I think that was the slogan, believe her no matter what. Black female, Felicia Rashad, black female, name escapes me, who played the role as Rudy Huxtable on The Cosby Show, spoke of Mr. Cosby, of having integrity, and I think people wanted to silence them. They didn't want to have no parts of hearing about the integrity of Bill Cosby. So to move on, I think that in the age of anti-blackness, someone will use that clip, and instead of just attacking the whole premise of Me Too, they'll spend most of their time attacking the black female. She's a sellout, she's a coon, and this will go on and on and on Twitter. So hopefully other black people, other black commentators don't use this clip to just, you know, go on and on about how this black female is a sellout. In Philadelphia, I think of the town of Philadelphia, they pulled the man off the bus for not having a mask on. That clip played and played and played and played throughout social media. But you have men marching on a state government building, if I'm not mistaken, and they're declaring that the state reopens. Man, just the level of just contradictions there. You know, I mean, some could argue, and someone said gave a good point, that we was living in a just country that practiced justice, black male on a bus, no mask, police show up. Hey, brother, I got an extra mask. Here you go. All right. Now, I don't really want to imagine if that were black males storming on a state facility demanding the government to open at the time of social distancing. My experience, I'm back at work, so white people have been very, very, very generous with their offerings because I'm delivering to their doorsteps with tips and just, you know, claps and thanks for your service, whatever that means. It's, again, we haven't spoke about this news clip, but there's also been a black female that has been pushed and gave media notoriety. She's working on a vaccine. People have dug up her old Instagram tweets, and she has practiced some form of anti-blackness, and that has kind of like took center state. That has garnered the attention of people online. So they've been, you know, pointing out how anti-black she is. And again, as I'm learning, I'm just really recognizing how non-constructive that is. My reports from the tri-state area, things are, how can I say, things haven't really changed from my last report. I haven't been to New York City, but, you know, here in New Jersey, people are doing the best they can do. People are, black people are, abiding by the rules of social distancing. And if they don't have to go out, they don't have to go out. In urban areas such as Atlanta, where we spoke of shootouts being in the Lenox Mall, urban area in Newark, New Jersey, the same behavior is still going on. So I just think that, you know, in areas where, you know, there's high levels of crime and an underground economy, social distancing, a pandemic is not going to stop the underground economy, and there will be violence still going on as this pandemic goes on. The Surgeon General, if I'm not mistaken, black male, speaking of contradiction, and I'll close with this. He spoke and he says, and he was also being accused of anti-blackness, black male. He said, refrain from drugs and alcohol, if I'm not mistaken. But if I'm not mistaken, liquor stores was deemed an essential. So liquor stores were deemed essential and could remain open. At the same time, black people are being chastised to not partake in drinking, because that too may contribute to blacks, catching the coronavirus. I'll put a period there. If I need have anything else to say, I'll leave it for last.
Much obliged, caller in New Jersey. Thank you for the update, tri-state area. Just make sure I get this in, since you did mention Mr. Biden, because I did think that was very tacky in the segment where they were talking to the mayor in Atlanta, Keisha Lance Bottoms, that's her name. Keisha Lance Bottoms, mayor of Atlanta. I did think that was very tacky, where they had to make sure they got in a plug for former Vice President Joe Biden, who I think is going to take a historic loss. In fact, I wrote this week that they should concede the loss now. I think it is going to be a humiliating defeat this November, and, you know, they can just chalk that up to the coronavirus casualty as well, Joe Biden 2020's campaign. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, observations, questions, suggestions, *61, if you have a hand up, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, this is the caller from Virginia. Greetings, everyone. There were protests here in Richmond. I had to look it up because I hadn't really heard about it. But they seem pretty small, maybe 40 people or so. It's confusing. I think your point, Gus, is excellent, that the information is just confusing all around. So in Virginia, there are two dates being floated around. Just two dates being released. One date is May 8th, and supposedly that's the date that recreational businesses should be closed until. And then there's a stay-at-home order for June 10th. So I'm confused as to how those two dates interact with each other. If we're supposed to stay at home till June 10th, how can certain businesses be open May 8th? So I think they're using this opportunity to confuse us so that everybody seems to be fighting a lot with each other about what the appropriate behavior and activities should be. In my area, I see people wearing masks. I also see people not wearing masks. I personally have chosen not to wear a mask. The stores that I grocery shop at are pretty sparsely patronized, so I don't see a lot of people just in my daily activities. On the good side of this, if there's a good side, I'm just trying to stay healthy, eat well, exercise a lot. I go to the track at the high school almost every day or as many days as I can during the week, and there are people there, but not a lot. Usually maybe 10 people could be there, and of course it's very big, so everybody's very spread out. One thing I'm not seeing a lot of information on, and this is disappointing to me because I have two college students who are at home, is what's going to happen in the fall for the college students. That information is not being released, and there's a lot of uncertainty where that is concerned. So hopefully that will change. You mentioned Netflix. I would recommend a documentary series called Pandemic. It talks about the other epidemics that have happened over the years, SARS and Ebola, all across the world. And I think that series was constructive, at least for me, when I watched it early on in this situation, and I learned quite a bit. So I would recommend that. And I'll mute my line.
I think that has been recommended on the program before. Some of the other folks who are more up to date on their Netflix, I think, said, oh, yeah, that one was constructive, the Pandemics series. I have not seen it, but I have heard a few from a few folks who thought it was well. The confusion, I can and keep up with going to the track. That's not even available at a lot of locations out here. The school with the track closest to me, they have locked the whole campus down for the last, like, month and a half at least. So you can't even go on the track. Like, but, yeah, since you have access to the track, spectacular. Keep going. That's distanced. Like, yeah, they've said that the whole way throughout. Like, if you... that is allowable, I think, by most of the states, the so-called stay-at-home or whatever it is. Get out, get that fresh air, get that exercise. It's so good for your immune system. Bravo. Keep it up, keep it up. Let's see. Other folks, number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks, we've missed totally. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Yes, the governor in the state of Florida has given the okay to... several counties that I am thinking that is in northern Florida to reopen beaches, such as Jacksonville. Yes, I did observe that myself. There is a sense of things coming back to normal where I reside. It was about 3 o'clock this morning. I heard 3 gunshots, so things seem to be coming back to normal. And I'm hearing more and more of law enforcement and fire rescue sirens in the distance. That's just a habit from that I guess I retained from work, that I can still hear sirens where probably most people are not paying attention. On my mind, I've just been thinking, and I probably could have, this probably would have been a good case to bring up on workplace racism as far as terrible things that can happen to a non-white black person on a job. And I think I mentioned his name before. He's in the NFL Hall of Fame, Bobby Mitchell. I'm not going to talk about him as a football player, but I'm going to talk about him as an employee of the Washington team that is called the Redskins. I just mentioned about the quality of how great of a football player he was, one of the best in the history of the game itself. Right as he retired, he was retained by the great coach Vince Lombardi, and he was in the administration. He had the goal, which he certainly deserved it, to be a general manager. If anybody doesn't know, there isn't really any qualifications to who was required to be a general manager. Just somebody says that you are, but it's a very important position in the entertainment industry or sports, especially football. He actually is the boss of the head football coach, as well as he picks the players on the team. And he existed in that status as an administrator for 30-some-odd years. He thought in the late 90s that he would eventually get – he would finally get the job and was passed over. And in turn, he was deeply hurt by it. He actually said that himself, and ended up retiring in 2003, but never being able to obtain the job. So he was on my mind. He just passed, I think, a couple of weeks ago, Bobby Mitchell. Former teammate of Jim Brown also when he first came into the NFL. But anyway, that was just on my mind to report it. And I probably should have reported it yesterday on workplace racism, because it's an ideal case, unfortunately. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Governor DeSantis reopening the beaches. Wow. Just for additional detail, they are reopening beaches and parks here in the Seattle area. They reopened some this weekend, but I think it may have barely reached 60 degrees. I'm not even sure if it got to 60, so that's probably a substantial difference between the Miami weather or anywhere in Florida weather and the weather out here. That being one. Two, they had lots of signs up saying that you're still supposed to be social distancing, and they said that if it gets crowded, that they would make adjustments, perhaps even including shutting them back down, since it wasn't, you know, sunny, 70 degrees. And so, now, if it had been the weather today or yesterday, if it had been the same type of weather it was that I talked about when I was at the park on Tuesday, they would have probably had to close the beaches down, because it was really, really crowded, and yeah, they were not social distancing. It was, you know, regular old day at the park. But it's cool, so now it's not as many people outside. But they have started reopening beaches, parks, all of that sort of thing, slowly this week in Seattle. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, comments, questions this year, *61. Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Yeah, I did see a whole bunch of white people at Jacksonville Beach. Certainly not social distancing, hugging and drinking beer and, you know, playing volleyball and doing what they do. Question for the blacks outside of the U.S. For tomorrow, so just in case I'm not able to participate, is I want to know what was their stimulus. What I've been hearing is Europe got a sizable stimulus compared to the United States, and I'm just curious if white people were, quote-unquote, looking each other out over there, because way too many black people and way too many non-white people here for them to ever, you know, do something like that. Man, these sickly, racist Chinese people who are evicting Africans and not serving them in restaurants and things over there, firing them from their jobs, blaming them for the Chinese flu. Sounds a lot like the white supremacists. They're catching up. I'm with the white patriots on this one. The shutdown is ridiculous. It violates their constitutional rights. But they've taken to the state capitals in Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania. Michigan had a huge protest. Bunch of people walking up and down the state capitol steps with signs. I think they honked their horns as they drove around the block for hours and hours, just honked their horns. In protest of this, had weapons, guns. They called themselves the Michigan Militia. Ready to take back their state. I'm like, I'm with the white people. Let's do it. So we'll see what happens. I'm with you as well, Gus. The way white people have handled this situation has been terrible, to say the least. The number one group of white people who are blamed for this whole bot situation is the media. Just the information has been inaccurate, or there's been so much different information that you don't know which one is accurate. They are certainly not practicing good journalism. I'm just so glad this didn't happen between the years of 2008 and 2016. That dirty Negro in the White House, it just would have been even worse. The census, a dangerous weapon white people use, dangerous. The book, packing them in. The census, I'm totally against it. New Orleans, man, if they dress like the Mardi Gras Indians, and then where are the Mardi Gras Indians today? Or are there any Indians you see dressed up like the Mardi Gras anywhere else in the country? I certainly don't see that. But the Mardi Gras celebration seems to look a lot like the celebrations I see throughout the Caribbean and down in Brazil, they call Carnival. It's just that I never see any what the people that they call Native Americans doing any of that. They have powwows and things. Black people already die from almost every ailment at a higher rate than whites, at a much younger age than whites as well. Mostly all pulmonary diseases, from asthma, even heart disease, heart attacks, hypertension, diabetes. The National Vital Statistics System gave their guidelines for certifying people with COVID-19 deaths. And in their report, it says it's important to emphasize that the coronavirus disease 2019 or COVID-19 should be reported on death certificates of all decedents where the disease caused or is assumed to have caused contributed to the death. Other terms is SARS-CoV-2 that can also be used. But as you said, as it says here, even if it's assumed to have been contributed to the death, they have the ability to list that as COVID-19. I mentioned last week a friend of the family whose mom died of heart failure. And when the coroner picked up the body after a couple of days and they had the body in their possession, they diagnosed her with coronavirus. But she died in a home. She had multiple heart attacks in the past. She was not suffering from any cold ailments. The family already knew that her heart was very weak. It didn't surprise them. So, but they list her as COVID-19. Then you had two different doctors come out this week and say that the ventilators are killing people. They said that they don't need more ventilators, they need oxygen. One of the doctors said they put the patients on the ventilator. Within a few hours, they go into a coma due to lack of oxygen to the brain because the ventilator is cutting off the oxygen to the brain. The other said the symptoms that he's treating resembles high altitude sickness, not a virus. and he's treating his people with oxygen and over-the-counter antibiotics, and he's saying he's having a almost 99% rate. So I'm looking at all of these ventilators that they're asking for, and primarily the cities where a lot of black people live. You go in there with an ailment, they put that down your throat or whatever, and, you know, you end up in a coma. Also, logic tells me not to trust white supremacists, especially when they shift focus to black people. Healthline magazine last week said early research indicates that the common test for COVID-19 may produce false negatives up to 30% of the time. Studies suggest current swab collection may have contributed, current swab collection may have sensitivity in the range of 60 to 75%. That means the specimen submitted to the laboratory for a patient with the infection will not contain the virus roughly 25 to 40% of the time. The collection process being used right now has 65% collection success rate. So the test that they've been using isn't even accurate. They don't even know what they're testing for. Also, Trump's been coming out with this five-minute test. And when you do the research on this test, which was first called the LAIR, it only could differentiate between influenza A and influenza B. And recently they got the patent to test it for streptococcus. Hundreds of patents for this machine, none to test the coronavirus, but they're saying this is a coronavirus test. But the name of the test is called ID Now. And they just received a patent a few months ago for a zinc finger nuclease test using a swab, which is a DNA test. So if they're swabbing people and putting it in this machine, what are they really doing with it, you know? So what happens to that swab after they use it? Like, they still have your genetic material on it. There's a lot of questions to be asked. But what I'm seeing here in Harlem is they forced everyone to wear masks. So I went to the store today. The people say, you need your mask on, you know, before I could enter. They had, like, a hall monitor, a black person there telling other black people what they can. They set up the lines in all the stores where you have a black person telling you, hey, go to line five, instead of you just picking what line you want to stand on. It's just to me, ridiculous. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
Wow. Forcing you to wear masks. That's Patriot Front. Like, man, he said he was glad this didn't happen when President Obama was in charge. I cannot, like, all of these protests, like, it would... I can't even imagine. Now, okay, so President Obama has to come out and say, shelter in place. And then the governors who hated him, especially the so-called Republicans, now they have to come out and support this. People are, you had people like in South Carolina immediately, like it wasn't a week later, and it, like as soon as this came out, like stay at home, like do what? I'm not staying at home. That's not even constitutional. Remember, some of this started immediately. So imagine if President Obama is the one having to do all of this. Like, woo. It would have been way harder. Way harder, I think, to get people. I think just because of the racism, white supremacy, you would have had a lot more white people who would have been willfully defiant just because it's a nigger in the White House. I could be totally wrong about that, but I have a lot of very vivid memories of willful defiance about all kinds of things when President Obama was so-called in charge. So, wow. Yeah, I'm thankful for my health and safety and well-being that, yes, this did not happen while President Obama was in the White House. Thank goodness. That is, I have heard about the inaccuracies of the tests, other folks coming right towards you. I have heard about the inaccuracies of the tests, but false negatives, unless I am mistaken, that generally means, as you said, where it's saying negative, you do not have the Rona, when in fact you do. Like, that is not good. That would, you know, tend to mean that there would be more people who have this than has been let on. Which some people, they did have that report this week where they said the number of people who died in Wuhan, they increased it 50%, that they had kind of undercounted. So I've heard that quite a bit through this as well. other folks who we have missed totally, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
M. Hondis, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings, and greetings to everyone. Didn't have a whole lot to say today, but I did want to say that I said on the program maybe must have been 3 weeks ago now that if white people chose to stop spraying the chemtrails or doing aerial chemical dumpings, that we would most likely solve this entire global pandemic of the what they're calling the coronavirus. Because the sunlight, a certain temperature, certain weather, it can't survive in a certain temperature. And if there wasn't chemtrails, then the temperature would increase. Well, then white people stopped spraying chemtrails so much. They still were spraying, but the very next day, I didn't see very many chemtrails in the sky. It was warmer for 2 weeks. And then here comes this week, Sunday, it's completely cloudy, and I didn't see where they sprayed the chemtrails, but I do know that when I don't see white people spraying chemtrails, and there's still, I know what the chemtrail clouds look like, I know that they most likely sprayed it in the rural area and just allowed the clouds to blow over to us, because I've seen them do that before. I travel a lot, so. You know, I'll be in my main city, and I'll be traveling away from my main city. And in my main city, I don't see the airplanes sometimes, I'm saying. And then when I go to, I'm traveling out to go somewhere else, I'll see the chemtrail planes, you know, and then the clouds just blow in the direction they were going to go. But anyway, the chemtrail, or not the chemtrails, but this coronavirus thing was, I think, manufactured by white people. And, you know, they were working with Chinese people. And this whole being against Chinese people or war against or the Chinese government or this invisible whoever, that's all staged. And that even though white people and Chinese people may be against each other at some level, at another level they were working with each other, in my opinion, to create this virus. White people knew well in advance, a whole lot of white people knew well in advance, especially those stars that knew they were going to get arrested. But they did a very good job coordinating and not really telling a lot of people, you know, what was going to happen, caught a lot of people off guard. But there were still people talking about, you know, a lot of stuff that was going to happen. And I've noticed with almost everything, white people will tell you, you know, right before they do it, they'll tell you, you know, so you don't have to be caught that off guard. I remember in the crash of 2008, market crash, they were talking about that for years. I mean, well, the bubble's going to burst and at least I remember 2007, while I was in the, I had just got my real estate license, and there was just they just kept talking about the market was going to crash and it's going to happen real soon, and then when it actually happened, you know, I wasn't caught by surprise, but I was like, man, that's what they were talking about. But I mean, it's like every time there's some type of a lot of times when there's some type of major event. White people had already been talking about it. You just have to find and they'll write about it. I mean, like, they'll go into detail. Even with this chemtrail thing, for a long time, most media outlets wouldn't even talk about it. And, you know, and then after, you know, other people had explained, have explained it. But after I went through all this time explaining it, like 2 years later, they start putting it on the news. But I've been reading, like, exactly the way I've been explaining things, but I've been reading about these chemtrails and what they're doing, blocking out the sun, all that. I've been reading about that for a long time. And, you know, in detail, just to say that things don't have to be, you don't have to be caught off by surprise because white people will tell you what they're going to do. But ultimately, I want white people to leave here. In white supremacy, again, I do think white people have to leave America and all the other places that they've invaded. And I really think we should really, really, really speak on that. And the last thing I wanted to say is it's kind of ridiculous, the mask, wearing mask. It makes it to where I don't really want to say hi to people when they're wearing masks. And, you know, I go about my day. I say hi to people every now and then, or a lot sometimes. But I don't want to talk to anybody with a mask. And it makes it to where I don't know, you know, if people are going to do a crime. I don't think, you know, but it's now everybody has a mask on. But it's really ridiculous. And they weren't wearing a mask when everybody can see the chemtrails, but nobody can see this COVID-19. But, you know, whatever. Okay, thank you.
Right on. I know there has been a great deal. Well, I won't say a great deal. I know there has been dialogue about Senator Richard Burr, suspected race soldier, who sold a lot of stock in advance of the virus and the shutdown and everything, where he was able to save like a lot of money as opposed to losing out on all these companies that are allegedly reporting that they have a tough time and wanting to get bailed out. And he is not the only person. There were quite a few. Well, I won't say quite a few. There were other reports, not as plentiful as the reports on, I don't know, the Patriot Front or toilet paper, but there were other reports that there were other white people who also had similarly suspicious financial activity in the months and weeks leading up to this. Now, if anybody has specific information that came out in like December, maybe even January, and it would have to be detailed, not just the virus is going to come, but like, whoa, if you want a passport, you had better put your application in right now, because the State Department isn't even going to issue, like, that's the type of detailed information that you would need to be actionable, so that you could be like Richard Burr. Like, it would have to be detailed enough, not just the rumor that the virus is going to be coming, like, that sort of information. Now, people are aware of where that information was available in, like, December, January? That would be good to know. Let's see. Oh, speaking of China, we did have said we've been broadcasting a lot. So we had the black male in China. He was on the program on Thursday morning. He talked about the black or African students, saying African students specifically so we can make sure we have our geographic locations correct. African students, African migrants in general, being kicked out. And he said that a lot of this is that you end up with a lot of African students, African migrants, period, who are overstaying their visa. And he said that one of the restrictions that they're, he explained it in great detail, but it was one of the restrictions is, hey, everybody here has to be tested. If you don't have valid testing, then that could be a problem. And he said that that is causing, this is causing trouble for lots of folks who have overstayed their visa, because China is not horsing around with the virus. They are spraying things down and limiting travel and all the rest of it. So they are not horsing around with people. Or I won't say horsing around. That's a metaphor. They are being very serious about enforcing their border policy and visas, all of that. I am sure that is justification for abuse of a number of dark people. But he did say that that, I think, was motivating a lot of the trouble, conflict, a number of folks who don't have correct paperwork. And the suddenness of this, where it's not, you don't have the correct paperwork, and you've got like a grace period of, sometimes it's like a year that they'll give you to get all that together, or 6 months, but like immediate, like you've got a day, and it might be you've got a day and you're getting out of here. So lots of difficulty either way. But he did talk about that in detail. He was just here Thursday morning. 15-hour time difference in China, but he was just here. Should be in the archives. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. folks that we have missed totally have commentary to share? Hands up. We'll see if they're in a spot where they can speak. If we have missed you totally, don't wait till the last moment. Again, we'll be here tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific, Global Sunday Talk. We'll be here Wednesday, Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington. We just finished her book for the book club, Packing Them In. We'll be a hoot to chat it up with her this coming Wednesday, April 22nd, Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We might even be on we'll be on tomorrow, but after that and before Wednesday, I just have to double check to see about the scheduling for upcoming broadcasts. Again, hopefully we are not just being active, but being constructive in trying to get through all of this as best we can, make sense of it without adding to the confusion, hopefully. Let's see. Other folks who are with us, do you have comments to share?
Can I add one? Can I add to what Irmhan DC just said, Gus?
Do we have folks we missed totally? Thomas in New York?
Oh, absolutely. I agree with his comment that whites tell you things first, just not for everyone to read it. And sometimes you can't figure it out until afterwards. But on October 18th in 2019 in New York City, they held something called Event 201, which was a tabletop exercise that simulated a global pandemic, which resulted from the new coronavirus. The program was hosted in October by Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, Henrietta Lacks, in partnership with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the World Economic Forum. I'm reading this out the USA Today. The invite-only event featured medical professionals, policy experts, and business analysts, all focused on how different institutions would respond to the onset of a deadly virus. A fictitious new coronavirus, being the specific kind of virus. In the scenario, it kills 65 million people over 18 months. The joint recommendation urged international cooperation, both preparing and for handling a pandemic. Ironically, on that same date, October 18, 2019, in Wuhan, China, they were still opening ceremonies for the Military World Games, which they hold every 4 years. China wanted to show off their first super city, super smart city, Wuhan. This is like a simulation. They already laid out the groundwork. This is how I look at it. They held a committee. This is what we're going to do, and they're doing it. They're seeing the world response to it's affecting everyone's economic. What we saw in China with people passing out in the street, throwing up all over the place, I haven't seen any of that in New York. And this is supposed to be the epicenter of this thing, and everybody's just going on about their life. It doesn't look like what they showed us in Iran, Italy, or China. They're hit first. And then here, it's like, what's the big deal? Everyone is just fine. So it's just something not right about this. And now it's being focused on us. It's like, is this a way to get rid of a lot of black dudes? Do we have to take some type of vaccination or something before we're white people friendly again? What is the key to this? Because white people don't seem to be having these problems. White people done paid me for 4 weeks of work and I ain't been there, and I know something's not right. Like, what's going on with this? This ain't adding up. So it's just something else going on here. That's what, every feeling inside of me is telling me. And I don't see what I've seen in other countries here. It just, the emergency rooms are empty. It's very odd. And I'll move on line, Gus.
Are the mass burials happening? I asked about that last week. Is that happening or is that not happening?
It was a mass burial, but like I just said, everyone who dies, you can't get the body, and they're saying they died from the coronavirus. Don't matter. Got a car accident, coronavirus. Got shot, coronavirus. So
Hang on. You would have to give me, like, direct evidence. Like, it couldn't just be, did you have evidence that someone was in a car accident?
I'll send you the, I just read it, but I'll send you the CDC vital statistics where they inform all hospitals.
That's not what you just said. Hang on a second. I do have my mute button. Not going to ask about that. It would have be detailed
about. I was answering your question.
Okay. It would have to be direct about what we're talking about. Yeah, and I do like evidence for that. But it does, I mean, they were not doing mass burials in New York City, like, in January. Like, that's irregular. Like, what, yeah, like, it would have to be something to explain why all of that started happening. And we asked about that last week. Like, is that legitimate? Do people have reason to think that's actually happening? And the same thing that I said with Imhan Deasy, like, the report in October, like, okay, that's interesting. That does not seem anywhere near as much detail as Senator Richard Burr got. Now, he got enough information. Like, whoa, let me go in here and do some reevaluation of my stock portfolio. That's what I'm talking about, detail, man. If you got that type of Richard Burr information, well, then, yeah, that is way substantially more than what we got from USA Today. Like, nah, not enough where I got to be guessing and all of the new where I have. And interestingly, Richard Burr, he said that that's where he got his information from. I just read the newspaper, USA Today. Everything was publicly available. I do not believe that at all. Like I said, if you have enough detailed information that, hey, if you want a U.S. passport, you had better apply like you should have applied months ago, because if you wait until now, it's too late, and no idea when you will be able to get one. That is substantially more detailed information. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, proceed. If we have missed you totally, proceed.
Yeah, have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I did see the report from Jacksonville, and it looks like it's some other spots in Florida where they reopened the beaches. And also, it looks like it is a high volume, a lot of white people. I don't see any gloves, masks, of course. And I juxtapose that with the, I think that's up in Michigan, maybe, or in some of those other spots where there's a large congregation of white people. I think that's definitely more evidence that we are in a system of white supremacy where white people are produced to have that amount of, large amount of arrogance and comfort, and just basically from what they taught, this is just a reaction from how they've been taught. You're not going to tell me what to do. Yeah, you know, they see white people in charge, but they still take it upon themselves to network with each other, and they were able to get it done, to at least get that large amount of people from what reports that I'm seeing to group together. And I saw guns, everything, it's smiling and everything, totally flagrant against the guidelines that they set about the quarantine. And this is critical, it's serious. And it's like, they're thinking, I'm still white. Like, y'all, you know, I didn't forget that. You know, I can still do what I want. Like, nobody gonna tell me what to do. So I definitely agree with that. And one report I did see down here was there was a person, and I think they're using certain terms to codify, but there was a person that infected 53, I think 52 or 53 people in a nursing home. So that was in Suwanee County. So they are up to about like 80-something cases, and we have a little over 200 where I'm at. But the term I heard in the audio segment was minority, but it was used in a way, I guess, where they're talking about amounts or whatever. I think that might have been a white woman that said, well, what's happening up in Michigan, you know, don't pay attention to that. That's just a minority of people. You know, that doesn't reflect, you know, that same piecing together words where they say it doesn't reflect this organization. It doesn't reflect the views of how we really do things. It's just a small amount of people. You know, don't pay attention to that. I think that's definitely practicing racism, because that's another contributor, just like the people that's protesting are contributing. They're doing the same thing. I mean, with the same result as the practice racism, but it's done through a different means. So you can cause even more confusion. All right. And then, you know, the president saying, hey, even some of these people, they seem to like me. See, that's the arrogance again right there. So all of them are pretty much contributing in one way or another. But as far as that, some good views being shared, and that's all I have to say. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. Other folks who dialed in, if we have missed you totally, proceed. Grant, we have about 30 minutes left in the program. If we have missed you totally, if you think you have comments to share, again, do not wait until the end of the broadcast to share. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Other folks have comments or folks satisfied?
Yeah, Gus. Black female friend of mine. She's a correction officer, just got diagnosed with COVID. Just real interesting. You know, she just basically came down with just a slight headache. She just felt fatigued. But she's all right. Matter of fact, I got off the phone with her some hours ago. She was doing yoga. I know you're like that. So, again, with this whole COVID, to go back to what Thomas from New York was saying about, you know, not seeing people, you know, just kind of like just standing, just dropping dead. And most people that I know, mainly one person who died in the hospital, was on a ventilator, dialysis, induced coma. You know, outside of that, everybody that I know that has been diagnosed with COVID-19 has just basically had mild symptoms that was cold-like, outside of people, that one person that was, you know, rushed to the hospital that was put into an induced coma. So, again, I don't know if the truth for the coronavirus, what we're going through right now, will ever come out. Maybe in the future there will be a whistleblower that will come across some documents that can really bring some real clarity with the confusion of the media and also our current administration and Congress. I think that we are confused and we have a habit of just placing the blame on the current president, Donald Trump, when you learn in civics class, there's three branches of government, executive, judiciary, legislation. So there's people to blame and there's people more to blame, and that'll be the executive and the legislation. So, you know, hopefully the future will bring some clarity, but that's my experience with COVID-19 as people who have, one person who have died and other people who have been diagnosed, but they're recovering.
Much obliged, sir. That's been my understanding of the virus from the very beginning, that it is not something that the vast majority of people die from. Certainly they're not spilling out and dying in the streets. I think the statistics that I've seen from the very beginning have been
the vast majority of people recuperate after a few weeks, like 80-85%, even older people, the vast majority of them, they do not die. They recover. I think we brought it up some weeks back. Retired firefighter used the term pestilence to describe this, and I said, well, in that definition, it's something fatal that's going to kill you, and that's not this. Most people, the vast majority, recover, like over 80% or so. So, yeah, that's what I've seen from the very beginning. I think I've commented on that specifically before. Much obliged, caller in New Jersey. Other folks, if you have comments, observations, proceed. Folks satisfied? I thought we had folks that we had missed totally, but hopefully they will not be waiting till the last minute. Everybody get in all the comments, observations, questions they wanted to bring up.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. So I wanted to say, as far as what I was saying, that a lot of white people talk about the big things that they're going to do, the tragic things they're going to do before they do it. They do speak in code a lot of times. So, I mean, it's not like you'll just automatically know what's going to happen just by reading a piece of paper. Like, you have to do a whole lot of thinking. My point was, though, is that they do talk about it. So, I mean, the information is out there. I just wanted to say that. Oh, and as far as this global pandemic, well, they've been talking about, it's related somewhat, they've been talking about doing a global economic reset for quite some time, for a number of years. They've been talking about different programs and the things that the things that they've been talking about, the only way for them to do to make that happen was for the globe to be shut down. Like, if you can't have the businesses. Well, anyway, that's really not my level of expertise, economics. I don't have an economics degree. My point is that they've been talking about major things that were going to happen, and then giving us a time frame, white people giving us a time frame for these events to happen. And then if you combine everything that they say, that's the part that I didn't say. You have to really combine everything they say and then make a decision. But from all that, like, I was telling my family, I was telling my brother in particular, hey, they're about to shut down these the borders, because we travel, my family, we all travel. My brother's traveling now, but before he left the country, I told him, hey, the way that these white people are talking, I don't know if they'll shut down the borders. I don't know if we'll be able to reach each other for a period of time. So we have to understand that. Like, we had a long discussion, but the only way I could have had that discussion before they were talking about shutting down these borders is of all the information that white people have been saying. I combined it all, and I made a decision, you know, that this is probably what they're going to do. And also, they put it in the movies, of course. And I sent you that email. I don't know if I checked it out. Of that cartoon that I said was talking about the coronavirus from start to finish. You know, they put it in the movie that you wouldn't have been able to really pick it out from
seconds.
That until the coronavirus happened. But my point is, you know, they talk about it, and we can figure out what they're going to do sometimes, a lot of times, not most of the time, a lot of times.
We could get substantially better at that skill, Richard Burr level. In my opinion,
that's when you have figured some things out. It would have to be substantial enough that you know enough detail that you can make a lot of moves where it's going to benefit you substantially, because I know a lot of detail about what's going to happen. If we get to that level of decoding, spectacular. Until then, we have a lot, spectacular room for improvement. Other folks who dialed in that we missed totally, if you have commentary, proceed.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, guys. I just had one comment and a question. The first comment was to non-white black people, don't be afraid to go grocery shopping. Like, I know they have a lot of these apps and stuff where you can, like, pick people to do your grocery shopping for you. Please go to the store and pick your own groceries up, because that's just, it's unsafe to do that. And then my question is to, does anyone think that white people discovered a gene inside everyone where everyone may potentially have the coronavirus, and it may be something that's triggered by maybe like your allergies or something, to expose the virus, now that it's, becoming like a common thing. Does anybody think that? And that's it.
Triggered by your allergies? What does that? Everybody doesn't have allergies.
Yeah, but in the beginning they were saying that it was like caused by flu-like symptoms. So did they discover something internally that can be triggered, something like the flu? Because some allergies cause flu-like symptoms. And what I mean is, it may not be allergies. It may just be just a common cold or something that triggers it to kind of, have a small reaction that make, that they're, coming up with the virus now. Because I've been thinking about that for a while. So I don't, maybe, does anybody else think that?
I don't, just because, and it might just be that I'm not processing it well enough, but no. I don't just because, yeah. Other folks, did you want to respond? I didn't really understand it very well, but I don't have a medical background. So to other folks, did you all want to respond to that question, if you understood it? Maybe they're still thinking about it, which is certainly allowable if you need more time to think. If folks want to respond to that, that's fine, too. We can give a second, or if you need to hear the question again, we can get that done as well. But just make sure you speak up and don't wait till the last minute if you think you want to respond to that one, if you need a little bit more time to process. Do we nab all the folks who dialed in with a hand up? Anybody we missed totally?
If I can say, Gus, white people have been very scientific. They have access to our bodies at a very young age. At this point in life, anything is possible with the vaccinations, with MIBC giving reports of spraying in the air. There's other people who have also suggested that they're spraying chemicals in the air. The late, great Dick Gregory has also confirmed MIBC's suspicions. So, I mean, anything is possible.
Did we miss?
I have a question.
Retired firefighter?
Yes, I just want to know if anybody has heard about a non-white black female who may have the vaccine to the virus.
Yes, I spoke on that earlier on social media. She's been being ridiculed for some anti-black tweets that she's made. So, yes.
Okay, I first heard about it from Mr. Tariq Nasheed's program. I haven't really did any additional study on it, but it's only at the point that I heard that that a non-white black person had the possible answer to this problem. And that was it. I was just wondering if anybody else have heard it.
Did we miss anybody and or any folks want to respond to the question we had from our listener? Grand. Will be interesting to watch how things unfold over the next few weeks. I think I did hear it said that this was not impacting white people. That is not an accurate report. From here in Washington State, they had a nursing home where a whole lot of white people ended up getting sick and dying, and they filed a lawsuit about that. And unless I've been misinformed, it's been quite a few of those where nursing homes where it spread, that was supposed to be a vulnerable population, where that's happened. I've seen quite a few reports where this has impacted some white people as well. Now, people say that they don't think that that's true. That's fine. It does seem like an environment where it's very confusing. But it does seem like people are dying. Now, people can debate, you know, what they think that is. That does seem to be happening, and it would seem like a lot of the same health problems that would exist, system of white supremacy, whether the virus is here or no, it would seem like a lot of the same types of things generally are happening. Could be incorrect. Try to pay attention to what's happening and make the most logical choices you can. Final check, make sure, did anybody we missed totally? I thought we had hands up, the people who had not shared, but I'm not sure. But we're not hanging on until the last minute if you don't have comments to share or are just waiting. Assume they're good. And we
have you heard?
Caller in Florida? Yes, sir.
Yes, Gus, I did want to mention, did you hear the, I think it was two metaphors of one person use the term behind the eight ball, and another person, I think a victim, female victim, said that if Joe Biden would have chose a green Martian, I think after it, she wouldn't have been the one to be chosen. So I guess that it looked like it was a certain way it was mentioned, like it still was kind of comparing herself to a so-called green Martian. I thought that was very interesting. But that's the only thing I wanted to mention with the metaphors.
I do remember the Green Martian. I think that was Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, Mayor of Atlanta, victim, when she was talking about former Vice President Biden. Yes, being compared to, I think it was if a Green Martian gives them the best chance to win. Yes, compare, because she's kind of being compared. That was the whole setup for the question was, you know, what do you think about that? He might pick you for his running mate to be vice president. Me, Green Martian, whatever. Who's going to get? Yeah, absolutely. Good, excellent observation. The eight ball, which one was the, if you recall, which segment did the eight ball reference come up?
I believe when it was a segment in the area, I think, of Missouri, maybe St. Louis, I think. And I think they were speaking about how the coronavirus is affecting the black population in that area, maybe economically or something like that. And I believe they asked for some comments from one of the black people in that area. And she says, I guess that we've been behind the eight ball before this started happening or something. I don't know if anybody else heard that exact same phrasing, but I did remember hearing that metaphor to use, the eight ball reference.
I think she did say that. I did not process it when I originally heard the clip, but I think she did say that, the segment that was talking about all of this in the Missouri area. Dr. Welsing used to use that metaphor quite a bit. She explained it in the ISIS papers, and you know why that has become such a important phrasing metaphor, not wanting to be caught behind the eight ball perpetually. system of racism where non-white people end up being. Metaphors important. Excellent.
Gus.
Retired firefighter. Yes, sir.
Yes. Thomas was requesting, could he get unmuted?
Not today.
I guess he got his answer.
Do we have any other comments? Folks are satisfied. We will be here tomorrow morning, Global Sunday Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. We will chat it up and see what the folks across, well, I guess they're in lots of different locations, so we'll chat it up tomorrow and see what their observations, particularly since a lot of the things that we have been talking about were not the case when we spoke with those folks 30 days ago. We'll tune in tomorrow. We'll be here Wednesday for Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington as well. Much obliged for those who tuned in. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Preserve your brain computer. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled. Shouldn't be going too many places, but if you are traveling, be strategic. Have whatever paperwork you need. Be buckled up. No reason to be stopped unnecessarily by race soldiers. Badge or no. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Kyle signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.